Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Iraqi cities under siege, Ebola cases climbing, ongoing tension in Ferguson, Missouri. Despite the disheartening headlines, you may have noticed that your Facebook newsfeed looks rather chipper. Turns out that the social network's algorithms favor feel-good stories. So if Facebook is your primary window into current events, you might be slipping into a carefully orchestrated feedback loop, which exposes you to mostly positive posts in hopes that you'll share the feel-good moments with your friends. Casey Johnson is culture editor at Ars Technica. Her article, Facebook's Route to Becoming a Reassurance Machine, appeared on Ars Technica earlier this month. And Casey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So why hasn't Facebook been awash in Ferguson news, which has been trending heavily on Twitter, for example?
Well, Facebook is, there have actually been studies done on Facebook that political discussions there tend to be contentious. I think everyone's had that experience. But they also tend to drive people away from using Facebook. They make people less likely to speak up, less likely to comment on other stories, less likely to post things themselves. So it's in Facebook's interest to kind of drive everybody away from that kind of content.
Well, Casey, a lot of people heard about this Facebook newsfeed manipulation study and were really upset about it earlier this summer. First, could you just recap quickly what that study was doing? And then I would wonder if this kind of putting positive news at the top is the result of that study.
The study that Facebook did earlier this summer was basically an experiment to see how people reacted to positive versus negative content in their feed, if that pushed them to produce more positive or negative content themselves. And what they found was that more positive content begets more positive content, and the same happens with negative content, but at a slightly smaller effect. The effect isn't as strong for negative content. So the positivity and negativity thing does come into play into politics in the sense that some political events can be kind of rallying cries, whereas some are more divisive. And it does seem like there's been a lot of divisive events in the last few months that wouldn't have benefited from Facebook's finding on positive versus negative. But it is all part of Facebook trying to figure out what it can put in your newsfeed that will make you like Facebook and will help you stay on the service longer.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. Why is it in Facebook's interest to have more positive stories being circulated?
Well, positive stories are, they tend to get sort of one-note actions. They're not the divisive, contentious discussions that I was mentioning earlier that make people feel sort of alienated from their peers. People are often, Facebook friends tend to be more acquaintances, and you might not know the politics of your Facebook friend until they post something related to a political event that you really disagree with, which makes you feel like you don't know them at all, and now you're afraid to interact with them. Whereas an event that's a little more one note in the reaction that it generates from people is it produces a more predictable reaction, and one that's, I mean, general good positive feelings from everybody is something that probably every, you know, marketing service wants from people.
That's the question. If you unfriend people, your network shrinks and Facebook has fewer people to advertise to. Am I following that
right
properly?
Yep, that's the problem also.
Can we change the preferences on our Facebook accounts to prevent this algorithm from manipulating our personal news feeds?
There is a way. There's a setting. They move it around all the time, but as of right now, it's on the left. It's in the left sidebar where you can choose to sort your newsfeed just by chronology instead of by what Facebook picks for you, and then you'll see everything that everyone, every brand that you've liked, every friend that you have, everything that everyone posts will all be there.
Right. There'd be an awful lot of information, but I'm wondering if there is a danger in creating a social media site that aims for universal appeal rather than a more realistic view of the world. What do you think?
Right. There's definitely that danger. Not that Facebook is anyone's primary, or it needs to be anyone's primary source, but it sure is, and it's increasingly so for a lot of people. And it can definitely be a feedback loop that, you know, you get wrapped up in your friends and family's events, all of the ice bucket challenges that are happening, and then you don't realize how much a certain piece of news might be affecting a lot of people in a certain area and how widespread its effects might be.
Well, I guess you could make the argument that the Facebook algorithm reflects something about us, what we're attracted to. I mean, we seek out good news from people, the ice bucket challenge or Bat Boy stories, rather than hearing about racial tension in Ferguson.
It's a certain kind of comforting. It's just that the concern is that Facebook, there's a lot of people saying that Facebook wants to be the internet for a lot of people. It wants to be the sort of point person in their internet experience. The danger is that it does become their window into reality when it's not that at all.
There are third-party sites that are trying to harness the massive reach of Facebook to their favor. Would they profit from this feel-good algorithm?
In theory, yes, they already do. There's lots of sites that produce the viral content on the internet, which tends to hit a sort of emotional nail on the head and sort of shake people to their core, and then they share it with others. There's sites like Upworthy or BuzzFeed or Elite Daily. They just have become very good at nailing that sort of emotional response from people using a combination of headlines and like certain types of videos.
Well, I guess we could argue that this is dumbing things down on one level. You're creating content for the greatest common denominator, but maybe more charitably giving the people what they want. Will Facebook be able to prevent this kind of behavior or encourage it of other third-party sites trying to jump in on Facebook's feel-good energy?
I think right now they are encouraging it in a way, and I believe they're also trying to stop. But the thing is that there's a sort of element to the viral content, the clickbait that's out there, in that it's universal in its appeal, but at the same time, it starts to feel a little like junk food. The more of it you consume, the more of it you see. It's the feeling is familiar, and it starts to sort of, the reward fades, I guess. So Facebook's way forward in this is to become better at targeting its content to beyond this sort of general feel-good stuff into stuff that makes us in particular, like each individual person feel good and reinforces their individual biases and outlook in life.
Oh, so that's interesting. We might find more partisan-based news coming toward us based on our likes.
Right. If Facebook can figure out who wants to see what, which they very well can, they can see, they can start, you know, trickling that stuff in a little bit at a time, for instance. That's like my speculation. But they can start feeding it in, seeing what you react to, and then building up your sort of own partisan preferences.
Mm. And of course, those first day of school pictures are pretty darn cute.
They are.
Universal appeal. Casey, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Casey Johnson is culture editor at Ars Technica, and she covers business, privacy, the internet, and new media. We were talking about her article, Facebook's Route to Becoming a Reassurance Machine. Now, Casey mentioned the study that Facebook published on how positive and negative posts can influence our emotions. That story made waves earlier this summer when Facebook users found out that they'd been unwitting subjects of a social experiment. In July, we spoke with Cliff Lampe. He's an academic researcher who's worked with Facebook in the past. Cliff said we should not condemn the social media giant for doing this kind of experiment. In fact, he said Facebook deserves praise for publishing it at all.
This type of thing happens all the time as people try to improve their services that they offer people. So in this case, what they did is they conducted a relatively normal study for how they would do things, and then they published it in a really highly respected journal, which to some extent is a great thing because that makes the power of the newsfeed algorithm available to people and educates us about how much we should care about how much these algorithms matter in our normal lives.
So they would do it anyway.
I don't particularly like that argument, and I know how ridiculous it sounds to people that they would do it anyway, but they would.
That was Clifford Lampe, bucking the conventional wisdom and anger about Facebook's experiments. You can hear our full interview with him at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, if there's one thing you can expect to see on Facebook feeds, it is an abundance of oversharing, from hangovers to money troubles to domestic arguments. Some people will post just about anything. When we come back, we'll look at oversharing as improbable defense for criminal acts. The PMS defense, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a court of law, juries are often asked to determine whether a defendant is guilty of criminal intent or if some contributing factor compelled him or her to commit the crime. Lawyers have made all sorts of arguments as to why a defendant should not be held responsible. Think the Twinkie defense, a derisive term used during coverage of the trial of the man accused of killing San Francisco's mayor and city supervisor, Harvey Milk, back in the 1970s. In this episode of the podcast Criminal, host Phoebe Judge takes a look back at the first use of the PMS defense.
She kept saying three things. I didn't mean to hurt my child. I don't remember what happened. I just got my period.
About 30 years ago, something started happening in courtrooms that caught the world by surprise. Lawyers began to attribute criminal behavior to PMS, or premenstrual syndrome. The first time was in England. A woman named Sandy Smith was found guilty of murdering her coworker. But her lawyer argued she was suffering from PMS, and the judge gave her probation for murder. Then shortly after, the PMS defense was tried out in the U.S. in a case that pit scientists against feminists against lawyers.
Serious topic here, folks. She beat her kids, and she blames her PMS. Should PMS be used as a legal defense? We'll find out. Take a break. Stay with us.
Shirley was on the bed, passed out or in a state of semi-unconsciousness. The child came in after specifically being told not to come in the room because Shirley was sick and couldn't take care of her kids, that they had to stay in the other room. She came in and she jumped on her. And she reacted in a reflexive way. She said that the daughter said to her, "Mommy, you hit me."
Shirley Santos was 24 years old in 1981, a single mother with six kids in Brooklyn. This is her lawyer, Stephanie Benson.
She herself called the police. And not only did she call the police, she didn't have a phone. She had to go to a neighbor to whom she said, "Look, I just got my period, and I think I might have hurt my child."
But if we're saying that PMS at this point in the early 80s wasn't in the lexicon, why did she know to attribute something to that?
She didn't say PMS. She never said PMS. This is what she knew happened to her at this time of the month. And maybe it doesn't take a PhD for a woman to know why she feels crappy.
A few hours later, Santos was arrested. Court documents show that her four-year-old child had bruises and welts. Her kids were taken away. In 1981, lawyer Stephanie Benson was also 24 years old, working for legal aid. She was assigned to Shirley Santos.
Had you done any research or reading or anything on PMS as a legal defense, maybe as it related to the British cases beforehand, or was this something that just came to you out of the blue?
It came to me out of the blue. And
this is Benson on McNeil Lair that year. Based on what she found, Benson felt she could correlate Santos's behavior with what doctors were learning about PMS. There were cases of women whose symptoms were so severe they felt capable of hurting themselves or others. She filed a motion to dismiss the case, outlining for the court all of the ways in which her client was, quote, a victim of PMS. Today we're used to women saying, "I have PMS." We haven't exactly moved beyond stereotypes about women being crazy at that time of the month. These jokes are everywhere, even on pretty forward-thinking shows like Modern Family.
God, they're going to ruin everything.
No, no, no. We just need to be extra sensitive.
Phil, honey, when do we need to leave?
Whatever's good for you, sweetie. Maybe 20 minutes?
12 minutes!
Whenever you're ready.
But back in the 80s and 90s, it really was new and hard to make sense of. Not only was it totally out of left field to assert that a woman's period could be debilitating, but it had very problematic implications.
What would be the consequences if PMS were admitted as a legitimate defense in court, in your view?
It's much more significantly a sword to be used against women than a shield for them.
This is Barbara Newman, one of the prosecuting attorneys in the Santos case.
No woman could ever be trusted with any position of responsibility, including having children, having the care and custody of children. This could justify assaults upon women. The man could say, "This woman was out of control. I had to kill her," and there's the woman dead on the floor, not in a position to refute it.
The Santos case may have been the first in the U.S., but the other cases that got the public's attention made the diagnosis seem even more serious. like Sandy Smith in England, we mentioned earlier. She was charged with murder after she stabbed her coworker repeatedly. Or Christine English, who ran down her lover with her car and pinned him after the affair went south. After the two violent cases in England, and now Santos, it looked like PMS as a defense was gathering steam.
I became interested because my branch chief at the time said, I have met an endocrinologist, and he claims that there are four women in his practice who attempted suicide during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle.
This is Dr. David Rubino, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and founder of the Women's Mood Disorder Clinic there. Today he specializes in the most severe form of PMS. It has its own name, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, often just PMDD.
PMS or PMDD is triggered by changes in reproductive hormones, estrogen or progesterone. But that triggering occurs only in a subgroup of women, a group of women who are susceptible to hormone-induced mood changes. And we don't understand exactly what causes that susceptibility, but it is a biologically triggered syndrome. And we can demonstrate that. I can take someone who has PMS, PMDD, and I can eliminate her syndrome by stopping her ovarian steroid secretion. And PMDD will go away.
So this is kind of the evidence that this isn't just all in her head.
Exactly.
Well, it's not really a diagnosis. It's a social belief.
This is Dr. Neda Stotland. She's a psychiatrist in Chicago specializing in women's mental health and was president of the American Psychiatric Association from 2008 to 2009.
If we really believe that, are we going to screen every woman before she gets a responsible job? What about all the flight controllers and the pilots and the surgeons? Do you think 7% of female surgeons or 5% are disabled for several days a month? I don't believe it. And I do have an objection to having this diagnosis listed as a psychiatric diagnosis without any comparable investigation of the impact of male hormones on men.
Why?
Because women's hormones are used as an excuse to think that women are unstable. You know, we talked about at one point, you know, do you want a woman to have the red telephone in the president's office? That's a very dangerous and negative understanding of women and a denigration of their legitimate problems.
Back in the 80s in Brooklyn, the Santos case got more and more complicated. Shirley Santos totally undermined her own case when she told a TV reporter, "It's not like I'm going to get my period so bad I start wailing on my child." It was a mess. It's still unclear whether she was pressured by the reporter or if she actually didn't believe her own defense. The lawyers made a deal. Santos pled guilty to a reduced charge, down from felony assault to a simple harassment violation, not even a misdemeanor, and she went home without her kids.
Why don't you think this has been part of the legal discourse since then?
You have to have a very special mixture. So you have a woman, and women don't commit that many crimes. A violent crime, women don't commit that many violent crimes.
I personally do not believe that PMS causes murder.
Again, Dr. David Rubino, head of UNC's Women's Mood Disorder Clinic.
I do think that someone who has antecedent behavioral problems may experience further compromise of their ability to regulate their behavior when they become increasingly symptomatic during the premenstrual state. But women with really severe PMDD do not kill people.
We talked to other scientists, just asked them, could it actually be this bad? They said yes. In some rare instances, PMDD could manifest itself so severely that a woman would be taken out of her ordinary mental state. And last year, the American Psychiatric Association put PMDD in their big book of mental disorders, the DSM-5. they classified it as a depressive disorder, saying the move was based on strong scientific evidence. So the science has evolved. What remains to be seen is whether or not public opinion has too.
Okay, before we go, I just want to get a, give us a round of applause if you think that PMS should be a valid legal defense. Do you believe it? Well, I guess that's that. Who thinks it should not be a valid legal defense?
I'm Phoebe Judge, and this story is part of the podcast Criminal.
Our thanks to the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for that story. When we come back, given all we know about football, is it immoral to watch it? The case against football, sure to be a provocative discussion. Stay with us for that right after the break when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In January of this year, a week before Super Bowl Sunday, the writer Steve Almond posed a provocative question in the New York Times Magazine. A lifelong football fan, he asked, is it immoral to watch the Super Bowl? The article went crazy viral, and Almond was praised for raising that question in some quarters and accused of being a crybaby who should, quote, iron his panties in others. His new book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto, charges that fans are complicit in the astonishing brutality of the game and argues that allegiance to football legitimizes and even fosters within us a tolerance for violence, greed, racism, and homophobia. Fighting words indeed. And Steve Almond, New York Times bestselling author, joins us now with more. Steve, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I want you to know that I did iron my panties for this interview.
I'm very glad to hear that.
Yes.
We were hoping you'd be living up to form. Now, Steve, you expect people to be angered by this manifesto. So first, can you establish your sort of street cred as a fan from an early age? Why did you love the game?
Well, I started watching, I think like most fans, I started watching because my dad watched football. And I think sports in general and football especially is really a way that little boys especially can kind of bond with their fathers and in some larger sense maybe be initiated into the world of men. So I watched a lot of football. I became very attached to the Oakland Raiders only because they were super good when I was growing up. And they were the, you know, I should have rooted for the San Francisco 49ers because they were closer, but they were terrible. So I rooted for the Raiders. And I really have found that it's ebbed and flowed, waxed and waned. But I really, when I'm especially stressed out or even lonely, the games have taken on incredible importance. So I would like sneak off every Sunday when I was in graduate school, for instance, I would wander up to campus and just try to find a TV. But I totally hid it from everybody else in my life, like a drug addiction, really.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you describe it. There's a quote from Caroline Knapp's book, Drinking a Love Story, as you sort of secretly kind of hiding yourself in this atmosphere that you don't realize is not your friend necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, the way I would say is that like any passion that we have, you turn to it in order to experience feelings that you can't reach by other means. But those feelings are very complicated for me because on the one hand, I was totally absorbed by the games. But afterwards, there was this weird feeling of just guilt and shame. And I was just like really a regressed feeling, which is probably how you should feel when you're a grown man, who has sort of important business to do in the world and you're shut into a giant emporium filled with chicken wings, watching giant men in tight pants bash one another's skulls. That's probably not going to rank as like super mature behavior.
But it does bring back some sense of that unfettered play and leaping and throwing in childhood for you. And you quote other writers who've described similar feelings. Your own description of being a kid, playing the game, pretending not to be afraid, you all feel kind of united and feel tested. You hurt yourself badly a few times and accepted the pain. Is that the footballer's creed? You just keep going.
Well, I think it's sort of like I think of football as a kind of exalted cult of masculinity. And it represents these ideals of courage, you know, fearlessness, self-sacrifice to a greater cause. I mean, there's even a kind of muscular Christianity that I think is folded into our feelings about the game. After all, we go to worship on Sunday, right?
Right.
And there is this feeling, it's a ritual, it's a pageant. It's very much concerned. If you watch the replays over and over, they show these replays of the bodies being really suffering brain trauma oftentimes. But to me, that's very much like our modern passion play. It's a desire to see the injured body as the kind of embodiment of sacrifice to a greater cause. And, you know, I also feel like in its purest form, football is this reconnection to the intuitive joys of childhood, the stuff you're talking about, leaping and jumping, catching, throwing, tackling, trying to evade someone. I took part in those, and I love watching that in football. The problem is that all that amazing, beautiful, heroic stuff is attached to all these very dark moral hazards that most fans, myself included, just want nothing to do with. We just don't want to look at it at all.
Well, let's get to some of those. We now know about the accumulated impact of all of those, you know, beautiful-looking plays, those lambs to the slaughter on some level in both professional league football, in college football, high school, and kids. Give us a little bit on the data of what actually is happening to players' brains after hitting each other over and over and over again.
So the NFL spent a long time denying that there was any link between concussions and brain damage or brain trauma illnesses. And that after a while, it just became obvious. Enough medical research emerged, and frankly, enough famous football players wound up killing themselves in flamboyant ways and then had their brains autopsied, and they found that there was this illness called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE is how it's known. It's basically a form of dementia, and it comes from not just from catastrophic hits. It actually, just as dangerous, if not more dangerous, because they're invisible, are all the minor subconcussive hits that footballers experience every single play of every single practice, just those little car collisions inside their helmets that don't register as a concussion or even an injury, but they are in fact the brain's a soft organ slamming against the skull. And the result is that in some players, they develop dementia, oftentimes years after they've played. But the really scary thing for me is, for instance, the study they did, a bunch of researchers did a couple of years ago at Purdue University. The researchers wanted to find out, well, what's the effect of concussions in high school football players? So they put sensors in a couple of dozen high school football players' helmets and found that they're actually just trying to see what's the effect of concussions. So they set up this control group of kids who'd never gotten any concussions, and they gave them, you know, tests to determine their brain activity. Here's where it gets terrifying. It turns out that even the kids in the control group showed diminished brain function, and that diminishing got worse and worse as the year wore on, so that by the end of the year, some of them had no actual brain function in portions of their frontal lobes. That, to anybody who's a parent or a school administrator or just a sentient human being, should be deeply terrifying. The idea that we send kids to high school to get smarter, to have more brain activity, and in fact, by playing football, they show diminished brain activity.
And these are subconcussive hits in many cases. 65,000 reported concussions a year among high school players. Now, the argument, of course, is that football is a way for young boys to work out their aggressions. You know, these are our would-be warriors. They're not going to stay home and crochet, as one of the commenters said in response to your manifesto. And that players understand the risks of the game, and especially in pro sports, are very, very well paid to sustain those risks. So they have free will. What's your argument to that?
Well, look, I, like every other fan, carry around my little suitcase of rationalizations and excuses. And every fall, I unpack it. And the first one I take out is, oh, they get paid a lot. That's their choice. They're adults and so forth. And there are a couple things to say about that. First, we're really not talking about the players. My book is really trying to say, hey, the moral equation you need to be paying attention to is your culpability as a fan. If you watch football, believe me, the NFL doesn't just see you as a fan. You're a consumer. You are feeding the $10 billion a year industry that is the NFL. And you're also making the decision that you feel it's morally acceptable to watch as a form of entertainment a game in which men might suffer brain damage, that you think that that is okay. Whether you want to face it or not, that's the decision you're making. So the first thing I'd say is it's not about the players. It's about the fans. We're the ones who built the football industrial complex. And if it's ever going to change, we're the ones who are going to have to change it.
We're talking with the writer Steve Allman about the sport that he love-hates, football.
That's right. My frenemy. My frenemy, the NFL.
Your frenemy, the NFL. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Raises a number of questions about America's relationship to football. It is our worship of the game, he argues, that blinds us to its pathologies. How about these behavior issues? We may have notions of what goes on inside of the locker room, this kind of jockish misogyny, homophobia. How are we as game fans complicit with that?
Well, it's hard to talk about this stuff because basically football is a place that I think Americans go, mostly males, but plenty of women as well, to not think about this stuff. It really has essentially the values of like maybe the 1850s, you know, in terms of how men and women are defined. And if you really just step away from the game, as I painfully have been doing over the past few months, it becomes much clearer. I mean, it's just men play. They're all hugely muscled men. They're all super aggressive. They are selected to be super aggressive and savage. And that's actually what makes them good, is that they're able to dull out their empathy and hit somebody hard, put them on the ground, hopefully put them out of the game. Women are pictured on the sidelines, jiggling, or maybe being a pretty fan in the stands, or the girlfriend or the wife of some player. And those are gender roles that are not modern gender roles. Nowhere else in American culture other than athletics can you really see that kind of like incredibly narrow idea of what a man or a woman is. Every time that there's a player like Ray Rice, the Baltimore Ravens running back who allegedly punched his girlfriend and knocked her out, right? And there's the video of him dragging her out of an elevator. And, he got punished by missing two games. And he also, wound up not having to spend any time in jail. If he was somebody other than a football player, if he was an undocumented worker, if he was just a poor person in this country, if he wasn't a celebrity and especially a famous athlete, he just wouldn't have gotten the same treatment. We give these guys incredible power, status, prerogative, and we really need them so badly, whatever they supply us, that we not only welcome them back with a slap on the wrist, but there were fans who were actually applauding when he returned to the practice field, some of whom I suspect have daughters or wives or, sisters who are the same age as the girl, as the young woman that he allegedly punched and knocked out. That's some bad values that we are taking in and expressing through football.
Well, we don't think about football in moral terms, as you said just a moment ago. So will reading this book ruin the game for football fans, and should it?
I hope it doesn't ruin the game, but I suffered through having to like turn away from this game right, the football season's starting. I'm jonesing as bad as anybody because I've really said, look, I can't watch. So I get how exciting it is, and I get the charge that it has. And I'm not trying to abolish football or lead some crusade against it. What I'm trying to say is we need to have a national conversation. When something is as important and as huge as an industry, but not just that, as an emotional and psychological force in our culture, we give so much of our time and passion and attention and money to this singular form of violent entertainment. We need to think about what it is that we're consuming. And nobody wants to do that. They don't want to do that when it has to do with their pleasures. Nobody wants to see how the sausage is made. Nobody wants to go into the slaughterhouse. We don't want to do that stuff. It makes our lives inconvenient. But you know what? Moral progress is inconvenient. And I think my hope is that the book will start a conversation so that fans are forced not to quit the game, but to fully confront what it is they're watching.
Steve Allman, he writes commentary, journalism, fiction, and soon to be a Whipping Post is my guest. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
I'm glad you're so optimistic. Thank you.
Steve's new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. So what do you think? Has the game been ruined for you? Is merely watching a sport that you have some objections to being complicit? Or as one headline criticized Steve's manifesto, Steve Allman, wah, wah, wah. You can weigh in yourself on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. We'd love to hear from you. Americans love an anti-hero. There are plenty in the NFL and plenty more in HBO's dark new show, The Leftovers. So why is this grim spectacle, which has all the trappings of a hit, being rejected by critics? We'll find out after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has all the trappings of an Emmy Award-winning drama, an emotionally complicated protagonist, a mysterious mass disappearance, a story by an Academy Award-nominated novelist, the showrunner from Lost, and the crowning touch production from HBO. So why are viewers and critics treating The Leftovers, well, like leftovers? TV critic Philip Maciak attempts to answer this question in his article for the Los Angeles Review of Books. It's called Get Lost, Why You Should Be Watching The Leftovers. Philip, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me back.
So a quick synopsis, please, or the storyline behind The Leftovers.
Well, The Leftovers is a show that is created by Damon Lindelof, who is one half of the showrunning team that ran Lost, and Tom Perata, who is the acclaimed novelist of a lot of adapted novels like Election and Little Children. And the premise of The Leftovers is that 3 years before we join our action, 2% of the world's population just up and disappears. There is no explanation for this. Nobody is able to figure out what happens, and in the 3 years between when it happens and when the events of the novel and now the series start, nobody has returned. And so we are in the small town of Mapleton, and we are introduced to a group of characters who are trying to deal with the fallout of this, what's called the sudden departure.
Well, just a few months ago, all we could talk about on Monday mornings was Game of Thrones. The Leftovers, pretty much crickets. Why hasn't The Leftovers taken off?
Well, it's a kind of interesting dynamic with this show. It's partially a show that is forgotten, right? It's not like Game of Thrones. There's not a water cooler kind of moment about it. But on the other hand, people are talking about it. They're just talking about how much they hate it. And I think that's caused a slightly kind of weird reception for this show.
So which is worse for a show, to be hate-watched or to be unwatched?
The interesting phenomenon that's been going on with the Leftovers is that all of the things that you said about, you know, it seems like a show that we should like, it's got all the trappings of, you know, HBO greatness, have led a lot of people to watch it longer than they wanted to watch it. And we've got this kind of, I think now we could call it a spate, of critics officially quitting the show, saying, I'm just not going to watch this anymore. It began with Melissa Mayer's at EW a couple of weeks ago, and now Andy Greenwald quit this week. And I think that people hate watch The Newsroom because it's frustrating and it gets under your skin, but it's still, you know, a pretty, you know, decently made serial narrative that keeps you going, even though you sort of despise watching it. You despise everything that's happening, and that's how people keep going with this. The Leftovers is not propulsive in the same way. It doesn't give you those sort of tingly moments of reward as much as other shows do. So I think we're seeing less of a I can't help myself from watching this than can I keep watching this.
Well, I want to go back to what you said about Melissa Mayer, who wrote for EW. That's it. I quit. No more. She wasn't going to be watching. And the show, in her mind, crossed a kind of Rubicon in one brutal scene. I think it's in episode 4 or 5. I'm not sure. The spoiler alert here, a member of the guilty remnant is stoned to death. And it's shown quite unsparingly.
Yeah.
So was that it? I mean, Game of Thrones was also extremely violent. Why quit The Leftovers because of this scene?
Up until that moment, there was a lurking suspicion on the part of viewers that there wasn't a payoff, that we were seeing all this anguish and we were feeling all this depression, and what am I going to get out of this? Where am I going to sort of get something back from this show? And I think that question was still unanswered at the point at which that episode, Gladys, occurred, when the woman was stoned. And I think for a lot of people who saw that scene, I think it was just the straw that broke the camel's back. That was it. Mm-hmm. If I can't understand what's going on here, why am I putting myself through this?
So some of the criticism I read, all bleak, all the time. You quoted an article saying it's punishingly painful. How do those criticisms compare to Breaking Bad or True Detective, quite dark and bleak, or The Killing, for example?
Sure. And I mean, this is something that that has been puzzling me a little bit about the critical response. If there's anything that TV critics have evolved over the past 10 or 15 years, it surely has to be a pretty high tolerance for bleakness. Breaking Bad ended just about as bleak as it could possibly have ended, despite the fact that, you know, the part of the understanding of that finale was that, you know, it was something of a heroic moment. And it's been a little bit strange to me to see so many of these critics who love Breaking Bad, who love True Detective, who love these shows that are as dark can be, who just aren't buying into the bleakness on this show. Why this show particularly seems more bleak than others is I think part of the mystery of the reception of the show.
But you know, you're talking about Breaking Bad, and I think of characters like his interplay with Hank in some kind of ways that make it funny, or Saul, the ambulance chasing lawyer who's now spun off into his own Better Call Saul. There are elements of humor that I guess people can latch onto. Is there nothing of that in The Leftovers?
I think The Leftovers, and maybe I'm in a minority here, I think The Leftovers is a pretty funny show. I think it's very much in keeping with Tom Perrotta's previous work, which is a very sort of dark comedy. I think particularly, I don't know, maybe I'm just perverse, but I laugh every time that dog keeps barking that they have chained up in the backyard. And I was very glad to see that dog at least came to a fairly good end. I think there is a I'm gonna say this. I think that there's something like a deadpan surrealism to this show. Things that are happening in this world are very bizarre, right? I mean, that's the premise of the show, is that a bizarre, inexplicable thing has happened. And sometimes that surrealism turns violent, it turns dark, it turns sort of terrifying. But there's also a sort of strangeness to this world that is I think meant to be, and I think very often is, you know, fairly humorous, pretty funny. There's a kind of Twin Peaks feeling to this, and again, also a similar feeling to Lost, which was this show that had this sort of surrealism to it that was often just very very bizarre and very funny.
And shares the showrunner with Lost.
Yeah.
Do you think, Philip, that the lackluster response to The Leftovers might have something to do with when it was released? I mean, it was in the middle of June. Could it be the audience? Is there, you know, summer watching, or maybe simply fatigued by recent shows like True Detective or binge watching Orange is the New Black?
I think fatigue is something that comes into play. I think also, and this is something that I tried to sort of put forward in my piece on The Leftovers, I think it's as much fatigue as it is that this show is missing something that shows like True Detective and shows like Game of Thrones that we've been expecting from HBO have had, and that is a really propulsive, forward-moving plot and a mystery that is slowly but surely being resolved, right? So audiences want this sort of plot resolution. They want to know that the sort of central mystery of a show is going to be resolved. This is why everybody hated the ending of Lost, is because they felt that the mystery wasn't resolved. And something that I thought was really smart that Emily Nussbaum in The New Yorker said, and that I quote in the article, is that there isn't a mystery to be solved in this show, or at the very least, the mystery at the center of the show isn't supposed to be solved. That's not the point.
Is it possible, do you think, that The Leftovers might be appreciated after the fact? You know, like Deadwood really caught fire after.
Right. I think it's a possibility. Shows that are difficult, like Deadwood, like more recently Enlightened, the Laura Dern and Mike White show.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be interesting to see what the eventual memory is of those shows. From 5 years from now, will people rediscover Enlightened, be talking about it? At this point, I think the real question is Leftovers going to develop an audience in its second season? A lot of that has to do with how it ends, I think, and a lot of it has to do with whether or not people sort of catch up and come back to it.
Philip Maciak, Assistant Professor of English and Film at Louisiana State University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Philip's article for the Los Angeles Review of Books is called Get Lost, Why You Should Be Watching The Leftovers. You can find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most interesting stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.